I call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, March 13th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Committee members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Chair Giesel. On the phone is Senator Klayman and Senator Wilikowski and Senator Myers. We have a quorum to conduct business with the four of us present at the table because I do intend to move a bill today. Thank you very much to Heather and Susan who are helping us out with the audio and keeping a record of the meeting. Two items on the agenda today. First item will be House Joint Resolution 29, ban on Russian seafood. And the second one will be Senate Bill 275, natural gas projects, income tax, and surcharge. So, first up, House Joint Resolution 29. This is the second hearing. We have heard invited and public testimony. An amendment deadline was set for Wednesday, March 4th at noon. My office received one amendment. Senator Rauscher, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one.
All right, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. I'll let you explain your amendment.
I appreciate it. So during the last committee meeting, we were listening to the invited testimony, Jeremy Woodrow and Representative Stutz. And so basically, we were talking about, we're worried, and it's a really good resolution, and we're trying to stop Russian fish from being sold right here in America. But we also talked about the possibility of it going through other countries, and I think China was mentioned. And so basically after that committee hearing and while we were doing, I was texting him, and I said to him, I said, what can we do in case it is going through another country? Because it's not really addressed in the resolution. It's the fact that we don't like Russian fish being sold here is one thing. So then he said, well, I'm going to go look it up for you, and I'll find out. I'll come back with some language for you. He did. He wrote it for me. He brought it on an email, and this amendment takes care of that in the way that he thought it should be presented. I, of course, every time I run an amendment, I try to go to the sponsor and say, hey, what do you think? You know, I mean, sure, it's your gig here. And I did, and I believe the sponsor said it was okay. So I'm presenting it today, and it's basically adding a whereas. Enforcement of prohibitions to this point has relied primarily on importer self-declaration and strengthening enforcement by requiring catch certificates for foreign-caught seafood as a priority to ensure the objectives of current prohibitions are finally realized. And it's a whereas. It's not changing the therefore. So that's what the amendment does.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rauscher. So essentially, you're saying that relying only or primarily on self-declaration, what we need to do is strengthen it by requiring catch certificates for foreign caught seafood.
We should be asking for that in the whereas.
Very good. Are there any other questions for the amendment maker? All right, then I will call Representative Stutz and her staff, Matt Greening, up just to find out what your comments are about the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. Good afternoon to you and your committee. I think it's a helpful addition, and I appreciate the efforts of the senator to follow up on this and add this whereas, because I think it will just strengthen the resolution. So I'm grateful to him.
Very good. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, I will remove my objection from this amendment. So that makes amendment number one adopted. Are there further objections? Seeing none, are there any other questions related to the amendment or the resolution? Seeing none, Senator Kawasaki, I'll look for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Joint Resolution version 34 LS1314I.A as amended from committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note. And legislative legal has the authority to make any technical or conforming changes.
Very good. Seeing no objections, HJR 29 version I or excuse me, version I as in India, dot A as in alpha, moves from committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached to the fiscal note. I will have members stay after to sign that document. Thank you very much, Representative Stutz, for bringing the amendment forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the expediency in which we move this forward. Thank you kindly.
Congratulations.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here. Next up, we'll take up Senate Bill 275 for the first time. Here to present the bill is, first of all, my intern, Ben Galtz, is coming forward. He'll be accompanied by Sonia Kawasaki, Senate Majority Counsel. I will invite you to the table. While they're coming, you know, there's always the question, why do we need whatever the bill is that's being offered, or build a resolution? And the why actually has to do with the fact that when we considered a gas pipeline in the most recent past, that's 2014, we've certainly considered at least two more prior to that, if not more, it was a very different project. There was tremendous transparency. The legislature was being engaged by the project proponents very closely. We had lots of oversight. But we also changed legislation at the time, which removed our role significantly. And so this now is a completely new project, and we need to take a look a bit closer at what perhaps we need to adjust in terms of governance and transparency recommendations. So, first of all, I will call on my intern, Ben Galtz, to give us a brief overview of the bill, and then Ms. Kawasaki will do a sectional.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Ben Galtz, intern to Senator Giesel. Madam Chair, following your explanation of the need for a bill like this, I'd like to briefly introduce how the Alaska Gasline Transparency and Accountability Act would address these needs. The specific provisions of the bill will be addressed in greater detail following this introduction. The bill prepares Alaska for gas line development in two main ways. It addresses the urgent need for greater transparency and insight into the governance of the currently proposed project, and it provides for improved fiscal certainty through clarification of statutes and the creation of new revenue measures. Firstly, governance and transparency. The bill increases legislative oversight of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation through more comprehensive audits and improved legislative access to confidential information. Additionally, it requires legislative approval of certain new partnerships and notification of further significant changes in ownership. These changes are intended to address the legislature's concerns around information access while maintaining AGDC and Glenfarne's ability to keep sensitive information confidential. Second, fiscal certainty. This bill ensures that AGDC preserves the state's option to take an equity stake in the gas line project or subprojects, and it provides for a reasonable length of time for the legislature to make an investment decision. Further, it empowers the Commissioner of Revenue to determine whether gas production taxes are paid in kind or in value, a decision that currently rests with the producer in certain cases. The bill also restricts the ability of oil and gas producers to deduct gas expenditures from their oil production tax, closing a mechanism that could lower state revenue without further legislative action. Finally, it directs the Commissioners of Natural Resources and Revenue to ensure that the state receives a reasonable royalty and production tax on excess gas that may be given away for free in certain cases. Complementing the provisions for fiscal certainty, the bill introduces new revenue measures. It establishes a surcharge on LNG processing that is structured to avoid directly increasing the cost of gas sold in state. Lastly, it applies the state and corporate income tax to certain entities, including S corporations and LLCs, involved in the production, transportation, treatment, processing, or sale of natural gas in the state. This bill will strengthen Alaska's fiscal position while providing the legislature with the information it needs to continue a constructive relationship with the developer. With that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to Senate Majority Counsel Sonia Kawasaki for a more detailed sectional analysis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Galtz. Ms. Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Resources Committee. For the record, Sonia Kawasaki, Senate Majority Legal Counsel. Thank you to my colleague Ben for the great introduction to Senate Bill 275. Thank you for the committee for allowing me to be here today to present on the bill. Madam Chair, you mentioned going through the sectional first. Is that your wish?
If you wish to go through the oversight or the PowerPoint, that's fine.
Sure.
That's fine.
Okay. My plan was to start with the slide presentation. The slide presentation basically goes through the mechanics of SB 275, and I'll speak to the underlying policy reasons for each of the sections of the bill. And it's sort of a logical and significance flow rather than through the bill directly by page number. So I will begin with the slides, and hopefully then we can round off with the sectional analysis, and I'll take questions as we go along.
Yes, that's great. I also want to point out to folks, excuse me, Ms. Kawasaki, just to mention Weston Nash, Commercial Analyst, Division of Oil and Gas, DNR, is online. Matt Kissinger, Commercial Director from AGDC, is online. Derek Nottingham, Acting Deputy Commissioner, Oil and Gas, DNR, is there. And Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, Department of Revenue for the state. All are online for any questions. Ms. Kawasaki, back to you.
Sure. So SB 275, Alaska Gas Line Transparency and Accountability Act, strengthening fiscal responsibility and transparency in development of Alaska's gas line. Initially, I'd like to point out that the legislature has a constitutional mandate to provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of its people. So to that end, SB 275 seeks to provide the legislature with avenues to pursue the maximum benefit for the people of Alaska, given the circumstances we find ourselves today. SB 275 updates Alaska's gas line and revenue laws under today's unique circumstances. It implements transparency and oversight in the project development process, and it implements reasonable financial returns to the state of Alaska. So we'll go through the transparency and oversight provisions first. First off, LBNA oversight over AGDC for annual post-audits and to evaluate ownership and management interests and investments in projects of AGDC. These will be annual operational and performance evaluations, and I note that these functions for LBNA exist in law already for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. And so we try to model those duties and authority of LBNA over AGDC for this bill. Next, AGDC may enter into non-disclosure agreements with public agents, expressly including members of the legislature and their staffers and advisors, for review of items protected by confidentiality agreements. Now, right now in law, this is an existing discretionary authority of AGDC, which means that they do not have a requirement to allow the legislative members to sign non-disclosure agreements. And they also, it's not clear under current law that it is permissible to have individual legislators review the documents. And so this provision would specify that individual legislators could actually access under AGDC's discretionary authority for existing agreements.
A question by Senator Dunbar.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Kawasaki. This applies to the last two provisions, and I think several of the ones going forward. Is the assumption that these provisions would apply to AGDC and relate to AGDC's role during the sort of development and construction phase of the pipeline versus after the pipeline has been built, if Alaska chooses not to purchase an equity stake in the line, would AGDC still have a role whereby these kind of provisions would matter? Or is the assumption that if we don't buy an equity stake in the line, a lot of these provisions would sort of cease being operational you know, once the pipeline is constructed?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, thank you for the question. That is an interesting question. AGDC currently has a stake in the subsidiary named 8-Star, which will have a, from what we can tell from public statements, a management oversight interest over the three projects, sub-projects of 8-Star, which would be the pipeline itself, and then the carbon capture facility, which is a gas treatment plant on the North Slope, and then also the liquefaction export facility in Nikiski. And so theoretically, AGDC should have some management interest over those three entities. Now, it would depend on exactly what the agreements are between the parties. And so not knowing and having access to those agreements has been a challenge for lawmakers to be able to determine what sort of policy would be appropriate implement for this bill. And so I would say that is a very good question. And we are hoping that AGDC would still have oversight authority and be able to acquire information on the projects that it even does not have necessarily an investment interest in.
Excuse me. What I'm going to do is call on Matt Kissinger, who is online. And Senator Dunbar, if you could articulate the question again, let me. Mr. Kissinger, can you hear us? And did you hear Senator Dunbar's question? It takes a minute to find unmute. He's unmuted. Okay, perhaps he isn't actually listening. It is our understanding that AGDC holds a 25% stake in this project, and that we.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Is this Mr. Kissinger?
This is. Apologies. We had something on mute that was needing to be still unmuted.
Gotcha.
But I can hear you, Madam Chair. This is Matt Kissinger calling in from Anchorage, Alaska.
Excellent.
If I could have the question repeated, I think I understand that it'd be useful to have it repeated, please.
Yes. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I can refine it a little bit based on the testimony of Ms. Kawasaki. So right now, it seems clear to me that AGDC has a role in development of these projects such that these provisions would apply. But once they have been constructed, if Alaska chooses not to purchase an equity stake, would AGDC still have a role? And what Ms. Kawasaki said is that perhaps there still will be an oversight role through 8-Star, even if Alaska does not purchase an equity stake. Is that your understanding?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, it's AGDC through 8-Star Alaska, as the minority shareholder in 8-Star Alaska, would have potentially a role in each of the sub-projects. That would be contingent on 8-Star Alaska retaining an ownership share of each of those sub-projects, which is the intent at this time. When it comes time to raise capital in each of the sub-projects, those project companies, though, they will be fully stood up, and they will each have their own governance. And so while 8-Star Alaska would assumedly be a minority owner in each of those sub-projects, the direct investors in those sub-projects would likely have a greater governance role. So in reality, without us investing in the sub-projects, our role in governance in each of those sub-projects would be greatly diminished and potentially down to none, as with any other private sector project in Alaska.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a very clarifying answer. And it means that a lot of these provisions, I think, would cease being functional if we are sort of cut out of, or 8-Star is cut out of the management of the projects after they have been built. Now, that doesn't mean that the bill isn't still urgently needed for the development phase, which is ongoing. I guess my question, Mr. Kissinger, is then what is the threshold at which point AGDC gets to do things like get access to some of this information? That is, do we have to purchase 25%, we the state of Alaska, many billions of dollars, or could we put a relatively small amount in such that we reduce the risk to the people of Alaska, but maintain some knowledge about the internal workings of these, what will be very large, very important infrastructure entities on our land?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, if you're referring to information flow to AGDC through this participation, what we've carved out is a 5 to 25% participation range. And so there is a minimum, and the minimum would be 5%.
So
follow up, Senator Dunbar.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. 5%. I mean, if we assume it's a $80 billion project, 5% is what, $4 billion? Or am I doing the math wrong? No, I think I'm doing the math right. $4 billion. Alaska doesn't really have that laying around, but perhaps the project will come in much smaller than that. Also, this is something I should have asked earlier, but there are three projects essentially. That 5 to 25%, is that just on one of the three, or all of the three combined, or each of the three in succession?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, it applies to each time there is an equity raise in any of those sub-projects. So any time that equity is raised, capital is raised and equity is issued, we would have that opportunity. Now, just to go back to your math very quickly, you must always include the debt portion. So when we're talking about the capital requirement, these are going to be project financed, meaning that they won't be financed on the balance sheets of the sponsors. But as with all of the LNG projects that are really being progressed down in the U.S. Gulf Coast, it'll be done through the project's agreements. And so you first need to take account for the level of debt, which we often assume somewhere between 70% and 80%, 75% being a good number to use as a proxy. So your equity portion is just on the remaining 25%, and so then ours would be the 5% of that 25.
Follow up, Senator Dunbar.
Just that's still $1 billion in this hypothetical, so not an insignificant amount of money. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Thank you for the response, Mr. Kissinger. Ms. Kawasaki, if you will proceed.
Sure. Continuing on.
We're on slide 5 now.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Who is this?
Yes, this is Senator Myers.
Yes. Hello, Senator Myers.
Yes, thank you. So I've got a question on the non-disclosure agreements. I believe that's the section we're on. I was curious what the penalties are for a legislator who might violate one of these non-disclosure agreements.
They lose a CDL.
Mr. Kissinger?
Yeah, Chair, Senator Myers, through the chair, as far as we can tell, there's very little to no recourse and very little way to enforce those sort of confidentiality agreements.
Further questions, Senator Myers?
No, thank you.
All right, Senator Klayman.
Madam Chair, Senator Klayman, I have a question as well.
That'd be great. Go for it.
Yes, Mr. Kissinger, it appears that the way that this investment option is structured, it's what I described as a situation where we're diluted, that if the state starts with a 25% interest and potentially only 25% of 25% in the debt structure you described, we're essentially in a dilution situation, that if there are investments that are offered and we don't make a similar investment to other investors, our share, whatever it was before that investment option comes up, if we don't invest in the same percentage that we have already, we essentially are diluting our interest in the project. So is that accurate or is that not accurate?
Senator Clayman, through the chair, if I can try and clarify your question, the way I understand is you're asking if we participated in one round of capital raise at 20% and the next round at, say, 5%, and the next round we didn't participate at all, where would we stand with respect to equity? And the answer is that it would be your weighted average based on how big each of those capital raises were and the percent that you participated in.
Follow-up, Senator Clayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what that means is that each time we would have the option to invest at whatever percentage we have the right to invest in, but each time we did not make that investment, the effect of not making that investment is our share overall would be diluted.
Senator Clayman, through the chair, it's important that we differentiate 8-Star Alaska LLC from the sub-project. So for this example, let's use one of the sub-projects, the pipeline. The pipeline company is 8-Star Pipeline LLC, currently wholly owned by 8-Star Alaska LLC. Our 25% share of 8-Star Alaska LLC is not dilutable. That's set in stone. Our share of 8-Star Pipeline LLC will be dependent, our direct ownership share in 8-Star Pipeline LLC will be dependent on, like I said, the weighted average of those capital raise participations. But again, to be clear, at that parent company level, no, that will not be diluted. Even if we never participate in a single capital raise, and even if we don't appropriate a single dollar to this project, we will not be diluted from that 25% in 8-Star Alaska LLC.
Follow up, Senator Clayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But if we chose to never exercise our option to invest in 8-Star Pipeline, the state would then never have any equity interest in that sub project or that company that is partly held by 8-Star Pipeline. By not choosing to exercise that investment, if we never invested, we would never have any equity at all.
Senator Clayman, through the chair, we would still have indirect equity. We would not have direct equity. 8-Star Alaska LLC will try and retain as much equity in 8-Star Pipeline LLC, much the same way a developer of any company, when they go to raise capital, tries to divest of the least amount of their equity and get the most amount of capital. So this has now become a very, very much just a private sector project, and it will follow that same private sector path. And so as we move forward, if we do not invest at all in any of the sub-projects, we will still have this, and again, at no additional cost, we will still have this indirect ownership share to each of the sub-projects through our direct ownership share in 8-Star Alaska.
Further questions, Senator Clayman?
Hopefully the last one, Madam Chair. But if it turns out that the bigger investments go on in the sub-projects, our ownership in 8-Star Alaska may not amount to a lot of meaningful equity in terms of the projects, because if the large money goes into the 3 sub-projects and we never buy into those, then we own some interest in a business that may not have much equity, because the majority of equity investments is not going into 8-Star Alaska, but is instead going into the 3 sub-projects.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, I think that would be standard across private sector projects where, as you raise funds and issue equity, you are trying to not dilute yourself, but you oftentimes do end up diluted. And so you're correct that the investment in each of the sub-projects will definitely result in some dilution of 8-Star Alaska's ownership in each of those sub-projects. The interesting thing is that we are fully aligned with the developer in wanting to keep as much of that equity as possible. So the developer is incentivized to keep that because they're also, so all the funding to build each of the sub-projects will come through those direct investments. And 8-Star Alaska will hold on to a maximum amount of share, but again, won't be putting any further dollars into it. And so it's almost like a tug of war where we're trying to maintain our position, us and the developer together aligned, but obviously we'll keep the capital.
Further questions from committee members on, I believe we're at slide 5. Seeing none, Ms. Kawasaki, I will allow you to go forward. Slide 6, or excuse me, you went to slide 4. There we go, slide 6.
And Madam Chair, I'd like to speak on, for these confidentiality agreements, which I refer to as non-disclosure agreements, when it would be legislators or public agents signing them. The way the phrasing of the bill is they call them, again, confidentiality agreements, but I'm sort of distinguishing them from what confidentiality agreements the AGDC has entered into. But the bill was requested to be written so that it also applied to a subsidiary of the corporation. In the last round of drafting, that didn't happen. So you see corporation phrased in throughout these non-disclosure sections, but it should have said corporation or a subsidiary of the corporation. The next sort of non-disclosure provision is provide an express avenue for parties to an existing confidentiality agreement to waive confidentiality in whole or part or in part to allow for publication of documents, including redactions if necessary. And these would include contracts, pending contracts, specific terms, records and files, and the confidentiality agreement itself. And the intent of this provision is sort of, we've been hearing a lot from AGDC and Glenfarne that they can't speak to specifics of the projects because they are under confidentiality agreements. So we just thought that we would provide in law for them in a specific avenue for them to waive confidentiality in cases that that senators may want to take a look at some documents.
Senator Rauscher, question.
All right, so this is interesting that we're going to go and we're going to install this. So I'm just trying to understand. So they've already possibly, and I'm assuming since they won't give us this information because they've already assigned some of these agreements with their partners or with those that are involved in this whole the pipeline or part one or two. So I'm wondering what happens to those contracts that they've already signed, which they've agreed to confidential documentation, keeping them confidential, not sharing them, because they may, whatever the confidential agreement was written because they were worried about, and now they're being absolved on our part. But are they absolved on those contracts that they originally signed?
Ms. Kawasaki?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, thank you for the question. This particular provision on this waiver provision has to do with the parties waiving their previous confidentiality. And so the parties to the agreements that you are concerned with are confidentially would have to allow for the waiver. So in essence, in any situation where there is a confidentiality agreement, legally, the parties who have signed the confidentiality agreement can come back and waive their confidentiality. So this adds to law that avenue.
Senator Rauscher.
Is this a must or a could?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher. Again, a good question. This would be discretionary on the part of the parties. This one would be. I think there is another provision forthcoming that you might be interested in for the same reasons.
All right, I'll wait then.
Further questions on this provision? Seeing none, I'll let you go on to slide 7.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sonia Kawasaki, Senate Majority Legal Counsel. Then the next provision would be on the effective date of the act at the request of a legislator, and as well as the legislator allowing other agents of the legislator to seek these non-disclosure agreements, that the AGDC shall enter into the non-disclosure agreements with the legislator and the public officials that the legislators would like. And they would also be allowed to speak to things in committee in executive session. Now, if I just might address Senator Rauscher's question on the last slide, this would remove AGDC discretionary authority to maintain confidentiality expressly moving forward. Now, there would be some question as to impairment of contracts, which is a constitutional concept. And I think that the impairment of the contracts that have been signed would depend on what the agreements say, which we do not know. So that's actually a hard one to get at. And I mean, we would just have to rely on AGDC and its partners and its potential partners on whether or not things have been kept confidential through agreements.
So follow up real quick.
Follow up, Senator Rauscher.
So I just want to understand, you say that there's possibly contracts that they've already signed that will not allow them to fully disclose what you're asking to fully disclose, and we have to realize that those cannot be penetrated? Is that what we're saying, or violated? I don't know the words because I'm not a lawyer.
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, that is pretty accurate. I think that the alarming part is that we don't know what those contracts say, and we would like as much latitude as possible to acquire the information that they have stated publicly is confidential, and therefore we do not have access to it.
All right, thank you.
Senator Myers.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So regarding the executive session, so that these things can be talked about in committee, my understanding is that uniform rules does not list this type of action as something that may be discussed in the executive committee. Could we talk a little bit about how the bill interacts with uniform rules in that regard?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I had not been informed that the uniform rules does not allow this kind of discussion to occur. I have observed in practice that the legislature and legislative committees have gone into executive session over confidential matters. And so I wasn't made aware from our drafting attorneys that was going to be a problem as far as our policy for this bill.
I'll just add, this is Senator Geisel, that a legislative budget and audit commonly goes into executive session, as does legislative counsel. It is not unusual. It would be unusual for the Resources Committee the Health Committee, et cetera. That is unusual, but our other committees commonly do. Did you have a further question, Senator Myers?
I'll just comment that there's been a legislative legal memo that has been circulating around the building the last few days around this bill, and one of the provisions it mentions in there is it is questionable whether or not executive session could apply in this way. I'd be happy to supply a copy of that memo to the committee and to the sponsor.
That would be lovely. Senator Kawasaki, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. We're using the term non-disclosure agreement here. Are you is a non-disclosure agreement and confidentiality, are we talking about the same things when we're talking about this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, thank you for the question. When I speak about the nondisclosure agreements, they are one and the same legally as confidentiality agreements, but in the bill, statutes use the term confidentiality agreement as a term of art for either the agreements that have been signed to keep things confidential between AGDC and its partnering entities, and as well as the idea that legislators can sign confidentiality agreements. So to distinguish in my oral statements, I often refer to the nondisclosure agreements as the ones that the legislators would sign.
Okay. Thank you.
And to put, practicality, this is something that we've asked questions. We've been told that's confidential, but there are elements that really shouldn't be confidential. And I understand there are numerics in these contracts that are commercially sensitive and must be kept confidential. Therefore, I've asked for redacted documents, and there's been reluctance to provide those also. But the fact of the matter is, we need to have more information, some of which is in these documents. So that's the practicality of the application of the issue here. Ms. Kawasaki, what slide are you on now? Is it 7?
I'm
on slide 8, I believe.
Yes. Moving on to slide 8. There will be in the bill a duty on AGDC to publicly disclose in an internet database information regarding owners and investors in gas line projects and purchasers of the gas. The information on the owners, investors, lenders, and creditors would be when their involvement is at least $2 million. And on the gas purchasers, these would include similar information, but it would also include the destination state or country that the gas is planning to be shipped to.
Question, Senator Rauscher.
This may be for yourself. So why was $2 million called out? I just wonder why we put that mark out there.
I would ask Madam Kawasaki.
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, thank you. There was a discussion in the public realm that there was interest in allowing individuals to invest in the gas line projects. I have more recently heard that that is not a pursuit that Glen Farne plans. But at the time that we came up with this provision, we were trying to limit the impact against private individuals.
Okay. Thank you.
To clarify, that is something that we have been told, that actually individuals would have to make substantive investment to actually be considered, perhaps more than the average Alaskan family would be able to invest. So perhaps, in fact, I will call on Mr. Kissinger to elaborate on that. Mr. Kissinger, for the individuals who may be interested in investing, what would the threshold be for that kind of investment?
Chair Giesel, we're actually not looking at a minimum threshold for that. In fact, we're exploring ways to make it similar to your pick, click, and give options with your permanent fund. Not necessarily tied to your dividend, but throughout the year, whenever these options come up for investment, we are looking at ways where a family could invest the smallest amounts to have a piece of this pipeline, in fact. And we're trying to ring fence that entirely within Alaska so that it's exclusively for Alaskans, Alaska families, Alaska businesses.
Thank you for that. And yet, the smallest amount that the state of Alaska or the legislature could appropriate would be 5%.
Chair Diesel, so in aggregate, through both legislative appropriations as well as the participation of Alaskans, we will need to hit a 5% threshold in order to participate. So that limit isn't necessarily on individual investors. It's on the aggregate.
This is very interesting. It feels like a new piece of information. And I think Senator Dunbar is also expressing that. Senator Dunbar?
Yeah, I mean, it seems a little bit strange to me. So if, let's say, the people of Alaska, through their own, you know, relatively small contributions, put up 4%, which is actually a really large pot of money, but they put up 4%, the state of Alaska puts up 1%, will we have a seat at the table to have the kind of oversight we've talked about? Will the investments by private corporations accrete to Alaska in terms of oversight and access to information?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, yes, they would. They would all accrete through one single vehicle, which would be a subsidiary of AGDC.
Eight-star.
AGDC has the right to invest between 5 and 25%, and we have the authority to extend that right to other Alaskans through these mechanisms.
Follow-up, Senator Dunbar.
And this was presented at our last presentation, and we'd be happy to recirculate the slide where we showed that.
Senator Dunbar.
What's the minimum amount of money a private Alaskan or Alaskan company could invest in this project? And would that minimum amount of money provide them a seat at the table?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, so AGDC will have a seat at the table, and these investors will come through AGDC. Any private investors that want to invest directly into the project greater level would be negotiating that through Glenfarne and not AGDC. The AGDC opportunity is a right that is just extended to all Alaskans.
Okay.
But in aggregate.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Let me just make sure that Senator Klayman and Senator Myers don't appear to have a question right now. All right. Very good. Let's see. Are we moving from slide 8 to slide 9? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, Sonia Kawasaki, Senate Majority Legal Counsel. This next slide provides that AGDC and its subsidiaries and business partners may not form a legal relationship with a foreign entity without legislative authorization. These types of legal relationships would be things like partnerships, joint ventures, joint ownership, mergers, and gas purchase agreements. And the legislature would have to approve the relationship by law. This again gets into the sticky area where there's a concern that we don't really have a substantive role in these projects, but this was an attempt to make sure that where AGDC has involvement, that AGDC should be entitled to as a business partner with, in the first case, Glenfarne, in 8-Star, that if 8-Star's, if AGDC's partner, Glenfarne, even decided to divest and give its interest to another company that's in another country, that the legislature would find out about it and that we could have a say in that.
I see no questions. Moving on to slide 10.
And I might add, Madam Chair, that that provision evolved from a concern that there would be divestment to foreign nation countries from Alaska's gas line. The next slide is that AGDC is to notify the legislature when an entity in a legal business relationship with AGDC has a significant change in ownership structure, and that would be a partnering entity of at least a 10% share. And if that entity decides to significantly divest and AGDC becomes aware of it, that AGDC has to notify the legislature. And again, the interest there is that AGDC presumably has a relationship with another entity, and that they share fiduciary duties toward each other, and so the other entity would have to notify ADDC if they plan to significantly divest, and thereby ADDC would hopefully inform the legislature of that eventuality.
I see no questions on this slide. Slide 11.
Next slide is AGDC may not further divest ownership in a subsidiary without legislative authorization. The model for this is essentially that I think from the discussions since we discovered of this plan over a year ago that Alaskans did not realize that AGDC could hold 100% share in an Alaskan project for a gas line and then divest it to 75% to another entity without their knowledge. And so this would just prevent AGDC from further divesting whatever ownership it has right now currently, which we know right now as in 8-Star is 25%.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm trying to wrap my head around the process. Legislative approval by law. So are we talking about, do we have a small group speaking for us, or are we all meeting to make this decision?
Ms. Kawasaki.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Rauscher, legislative approval by law means enacting a law, and so that would require AGDC and other participants to come forward and speak to the legislature about it so that the legislature can gain a full understanding to decide whether or not to allow ADDC to further divest.
So follow up. So yes. Then we are to authorize it. That's the word you're using here. So we actually authorize it after they come before us and talk to us.
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So it would not be a decision by LBNA during the time we're out of session.
That's kind of where I was getting.
Yes, this would not be authorized to LBNA to make that decision.
Okay.
Good. I see no other questions. Let me just make sure. Senator Myers has a question, I think. Senator Myers, do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. So both the provisions on slide 11 and the provisions on slide 9. With the legislative approval of contracts, my understanding is that it's questionable whether or not that is constitutional on separation of powers grounds. I believe there's a AG opinion from the late 70s that has suggested that is not constitutional. I would have to double check to see if that has been adjudicated with the Alaska Supreme Court or not. But I was wondering if Ms. Kawasaki could comment on that.
Ms. Kawasaki.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Senator Myers, for the question. I read the AG opinion on which our drafting attorneys suggested that it might be a separation of powers violation to allow the legislature or to approve things by law. It has not been adjudicated, and I, as an attorney, would definitely argue that that is inaccurate because the law would enable the approval, and the law is a separation of powers principle as it is. This is the lawmaking branch, and the lawmaking branch typically enacts laws that would allow the legislature authorize the executive branch departments to do or not do things. So from my point of view, I think that our position would be that this is not approving a contract. It is not violating because separation of powers principles, because in actuality, we are just requiring performance or of an action, and that is what we do all the time in law. And then I might also point out that there are several instances in law already wherein the legislature is approving contracts specifically, not just actions, but the first one being AS 4242-85, legislative approval required by the Alaska Railroad Corporation, unless the legislature approves of the action by law, the corporation may not. And as an example, one of them is issue bonds. The second one is AS 4382-435, legislative authorization, which was for a contract. This was actually for the Alaska Stranded Gas Development Act, so it actually is in the same sort of context as we're talking about here. A contract developed under this chapter is not binding upon or enforceable against the state or other parties to the contract unless the governor is authorized to execute the contract by law, and by law means the legislature has enacted a law. The third one, AS 3806-055, legislative approval. The Commissioner of Resources may not enter into a sale, exchange, or other disposition of oil or gas of the, or the rights or waiver of the rights to receive future production of royalty or gas under another provision of law without prior approval by the legislature. The next one is actually related to that provision. It is on the sale, or I apologize, Madam Chair. This is taking royalty in money that you, the legislature must approve of the taking of royalty in money. And that is under our Natural Resources Department. And then I do point out also that there's currently a bill being considered that is titled An Act Approving and Ratifying the Sale of Royalty Oil by the State of Alaska to Marathon Petroleum Supply and Trading Company. This is HB 194, and it is currently sitting in House Rules. It's gone through both bodies, and it's sitting in House Rules right now for concurrence by the House. And then the provision of law that over which governs that also says upon legislative approval, the commissioner may not enter into contracts to sell royalty gas in kind. And that is the basis of HB 194. And then again, a similar concept, the salary commission that comes up with compensation for, the state officers compensation commission comes up with salaries for executive branch commissioners and the legislators, and again the legislative authorization is involved in there because if you if the legislature chooses not to concur or ratify the salaries, then that has then rejected the action of the salary commission. And so I would say I disagree with the executive branch that the 1979 or what, Attorney General's opinion, it has not been adjudicated. There's been plenty of opportunities for it to be adjudicated, and I suspect that even if it were adjudicated, that it would be found not to be violative of the Constitution. And then I also, Madam Chair, have been reviewing this old heads of agreement from 2014, which was the old gas line development
the
previous corporation.
One.
Yes, sorry.
The previous one
in which the Alaska had intended more involvement than the current situation. And the heads of agreement was between the administration of the state of Alaska and then AGDC, TransCanada, and then three publicly traded corporations, which were ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and BP Exploration. And at that time, the heads of agreement made very clear that the legislature would be involved with ratifying contracts. And so I just wanted to bring that to everyone's attention. These situations with the legislature involved in ratifying contracts approving of actions of executive branches is not like an unusual situation in Alaska state law.
Thank you, Ms. Kawasaki. Are there further questions on slide 11? Seeing none, I'll let you move on to actually slide 12 and 13.
Sure. Thank you again. For the record, Senator Kawasaki, Senate Majority Legal Counsel. We move on now to the financial returns provisions, which are very important given the current situation versus, again, what I brought up with the heads-up agreement. They're Alaskans did think that we would be receiving a lot greater share, which right now, as the bill is trying to address, there's concerns that we could see potentially no returns for our involvement or our gas line. And the bill tries to enact provisions that would prevent that situation. So the first one would be eliminating deductions against oil production taxes for gas lease expenditures. Currently in law, when an oil and gas development company expends on capital for capital improvements for oil or gas, they get to deduct their gas lease expenditures. There is a concern in particular with allowing the gas lease expenditures to be deducted from their oil production taxes because there's the gas expenditures could be very, very substantial, and the tax deductions could be so great that we would see negative numbers of production tax revenue. So that was something that was very concerning to many of the policymakers that I worked with, and that was something that we wanted to address in the bill. This would apply only to North Slope producers.
Very good. Senator Rauscher.
Through the chair. So that means even if they're operating at a loss, is that what you're saying? That we don't care? Well, they could be operating at a loss if they can't deduct expenditures.
I'm sorry. Okay, so Senator Giesel, through the chair.
Senator Rauscher.
Okay. I think... if you're meaning that they would be operating at a loss because they've spent more than they're going to make in profit and then also paying our taxes, so your concern would be that they are paying oil production taxes, but they spend a whole lot on gas lease expenditures that they wanted to deduct against their oil production taxes and bring their oil production taxes down to zero or below zero.
Yeah. Couldn't happen.
Senator Rauscher, that is a possibility that could happen, and I think we're trying to prevent them from, to the detriment of the state, deducting so much that they end up diminishing the revenue to the state to nothing.
This is, of course, a piece that will be financially modeled. Thank you for the question, and we will be taking a look at that, Senator Rauscher.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for clarity, though, they could still deduct their gas lease expenditures off the revenues off the gas, right? I mean, what we're talking about is them taking the gas lease expenditures and applying it to like a different field where there's existing oil revenues, right?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that is actually an interesting question because the laws right now, from what I read of the laws, there was not in place a provision to allow gas lease expenditures to be deducted from gas taxes. And I am not sure how that developed in law, but from my reading of the law, their oil and gas lease expenditures right now can be deducted from oil production taxes. There is no separate gas production tax from which gas lease expenditures can be.
That's a good point. We can't. There's already no tax, so they can't go against that zero tax.
Senator Dunbar, just a bit of history. Really what we're talking about here is decoupling. The term is decoupling. Senator Stedman actually offered a decoupling policy in 2010 in what was Senate Bill 305. And so right now we do not have that in law. This is similar to what Senator Stedman had offered at the time. So I suspect this will be a significant discussion and probably need to be fleshed out a bit more. But the concept is just what you described. Lease expenditures for gas will now need to be separated. Any other questions on this particular slide, which was 13?
This was 13.
All right.
Madam Chair, if I might make another point on, just to get an order of magnitude here, we know that Point Thompson was meant to supply gas to the gas pipeline. They are in development right now. They're close to a 4 to $5 billion to fully develop the gas. And so imagine deducting $4 to $5 billion off of their oil production taxes. And I'll
move on. You'd have to eliminate the PFD. I mean, that's what would happen.
Further questions on slide? We were on 13. Now we're moving to 14.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide 14, a gas producer may no longer unilaterally elect to pay gas production taxes in physical gas instead of monetary payment, and it also reverses the election to allow the state to elect to accept the gas in physical gas. This would apply to North Slope producers, and the DOR commissioner would make a written determination on the best interest of whether it would be appropriate for the state's best interest to take physical gas product rather than monetary taxes, and then submit it to the legislature at the next session, in which the legislature and a similar approval process, but basically could revoke the determination by a concurrent resolution.
So when, just again, a little history, I know many of us were here, but when it was the Exxon-led project by the three producers, we did discuss with them the concept of taking some of the gas in kind and then contracting with them to sell it on our behalf on the open market. This is not something that's an opportunity here. That was a common carrier scenario. This is a private pipeline. They'll be buying at the wellhead, so it's a completely different scenario, and that's why this is being addressed here as it is. Very good. I am not seeing questions from Senator Klayman, Meyer, or Willikowski on this slide, so we can go on to number 15.
Madam Chair, the next slide has to do with Department of Revenue to ensure that production tax is appropriately paid even when oil or gas is sold at a price that does not represent reasonably prevailing value. And the Department of Revenue must determine a reasonably prevailing value and publish that on an online specific publish online a specific written rationale. And the goal is to get at a value that is of the same kind and character of the prevailing value for the field, and may not use other unreasonable low-cost oil or gas for the basis of the valuation. And then summaries would be made available online, and there would be a full written report on available at request. Now, the reason that this is an important provision is because the tax in law right now is 13% at the gross of the gross value at the point of production. So it is a percentage of the value. And we are hearing a lot in the last few months that there's a possibility that there are producers who would prefer to, you know, provide gas for essentially next to nothing, essentially low costs, low prices. And so if we had 13% production tax of low to no cost oil or gas, then we would get 13% of zero.
Any questions on this slide? We do have existing statute addressing prevailing value in AS 4355-020, subsection F as in Fairbanks. I see no questions. Going on now to 16. Very good.
So similarly to the Department of Revenue's duty to ensure production tax would be paid appropriately, even if the value of the oil, the price of the oil has the arm's length exchange was very low, we would want to ensure that our royalty is appropriately paid. Normally, this is 12.5% of the volume or the value of the royalty. And so this would be just a very, very similar concept to the Department of Revenue's duty, and it would be same quality and kind of character in a prevailing in the field. And, you know, the valuation may not be based on other unreasonably low oil or gas. And again, a summary would be published and available written report.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to envision when a company or how a company would do this. How would they then make a profit? If they're selling it at a price that doesn't represent a reasonable value, if they're selling it at a very low price, is the worry that they would sell it at a very low price at the wellhead and then find a way to make profit at the LNG facility and in that way avoid paying a royalty? Or it just seems like if they're selling it at such a low value, then it's true that Alaska wouldn't be getting our appropriate value, but neither would the company, right? So can you explain to me why a company would do this?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that would be a good question, but we have heard anecdotally and in hearings in the last few months that there are transactions being prepared for that would allow very low cost gas to be sold for low cost at the wellhead to Glenfarne, and that is a different situation than we can think of the model of, for instance, the Trans-Alaska pipeline. There's a production situation, and once the oil or gas is produced, the oil is the royalty is taken at the wellhead, and the production value is determined on the production value statutes, production tax value statutes. So the only thing I could think of perhaps is maybe if there's a deal to provide low cost gas at the wellhead in which the same producer might be invested in one of these sub-projects or whatnot, and then they still manage to make some money off of being involved in the gas pipeline projects.
It has been noted in the media, certainly, a company that is not yet producing anything has said, frankly, the gas is not of value to them. They're actually going after the oil. And so they've made the comment, perhaps we would simply give them the gas. So to address that potentiality, though bizarre as it might seem, Senator Rauscher, then Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm wondering, does this apply to in-state use, that there can be no price difference?
Through the chair, Senator Rauscher, in-state, you mean distinguishing between in-state use and export? Mm-hmm. Yes. This would not distinguish, but the existing statutes for taxation and royalty don't distinguish between in-state and out-of-state product use.
So I'm just trying Senator to wrap Kosa, my head around how we're going to be able to Senator get low-cost Rauscher. Gas to the – I'm sorry, follow-up. How we're going to get low-cost gas to the interior. So I'm just trying to figure it out.
Many complexities there, certainly, Senator Rauscher, the spur being probably the largest complexity. But the royalty is owed regardless, and that's what is being addressed here, right? The royalty comes to the state regardless. Right. Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. I think I need to back way, way up and try and figure out what is the value of the gas that is being produced at the point of production. Because we know what oil is, but we don't have a value, say, pinned to like ANS crude, which is a commodity, you know, a commodities market system.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, thank you for the question. I know from past historic discussions on this gas line that there was some thought that a value of $4 per 1,000 cubic feet was discussed. More recently, in internal calculations, we were considering, you know, what if the value, the prevailing value that we request of DOR or DNR to come up with would be around $1 per MCF. And so Senator Kawasaki is correct that there isn't really a model for this, but it would have to do with the market demands and, you know, with the fact that Alaska is situated in the United States, has the largest oil gas reserves available to be tapped, you know, we would be hopeful that the value would be something significant enough that the state can actually receive a return on the fact that we are the legislature has oversight over natural resources of the state.
Senator Kawasaki, what we are hearing through questions about the contracts that are being signed is that that selling price is being individually negotiated with the producers, individually negotiated with Conoco, with Hillcorp, with Exxon. So it's not public information, is my understanding. Perhaps, Mr. Kissinger, I assume you're still there listening. How is the price of the gas being produced by the different, or being sold to you, or excuse me, Glenfarne, how is that being determined? How is the price being determined?
Chair Diesel, it's being determined in the same manner that any private sector price discovery would occur. It happens through a direct negotiation between two independent arm's length parties. And so it's hard to say that there would be any other price that could be relevant because, you know, traditionally a market price would be your market. And that's exactly what this is. It's a market transaction.
Very good. Thank you. Follow up, Senator Kawasaki?
Sure. To Mr. Kissinger. So who's our market?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, the market in this case is Glenfarne or 8-Star purchasing that gas. And then 8-Star has its market on the downstream side, which is really two separate markets. There's a domestic market that we sell into, and then obviously ultimately there's the LNG market that you sell into. The price of the purchase of the gas is a separate transaction than the downstream sales of gas. And again, this is a transaction being negotiated by two arm's length parties. There couldn't be anything more traditional in the sort of, you know, private sector than that.
Okay.
I think, Senator Kawasaki, that this will be information. It's my understanding this information will be available to the Department of Revenue, who has oil profitability also. But it is confidential because we have so few. They amalgamate. They take the numbers and average them. I'm losing the word there, but I think it's the same kind of scenario. Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm trying to understand market rate now. Is Henry Hub is what $3.50, and Cook Inlet's at $8 something right now, and later on it could be 13, I believe, if you start talking about the contracts that are going out. So what is market rate? I guess I'm trying to understand how do we figure value here?
Senator Rauscher, that is delegated to the Department of Revenue when they look at the prevailing value, but the contracts themselves between the companies will decide what the price is that the companies are selling it for.
Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Mr. Kissinger?
Senator Klayman.
Oh, Senator Klayman. I'm sorry. Yes, Senator Klayman. Question.
Okay. I wanted to follow back with Mr. Kissinger. When he's talking about market, I would largely agree that when you get to the downstream point at which they're selling to different purchasers at the end of the pipeline or at the end of the transportation, but that's very much an open market because there's more than one buyer, or presumably there's more than one buyer in that environment. But even though you've got a willing buyer and a willing seller, when the producer is selling to Glenfarne, it's not really a market situation because there's no competition in the purchase. Am I missing something, or are we really not looking at a true market situation?
Mr. Kissinger?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, there are multiple sellers of this. And so when these gas sales agreements are being negotiated, they're not being negotiated with the producers all as one. Each producer is in bilateral negotiations, and that's where your market force comes from. Pantheon and Hillcorp and Exxon and ConocoPhillips and other sellers of gas up on the North Slope all competing for the purchaser, for the buyer. And so there are multiple sellers in this case. In the same way that on the downstream side, as you rightly point out, there are multiple buyers.
Follow-up, Senator Klayman?
But on the upstream side, thank you, Madam Chair, but on the upstream side, there's only one buyer, and there may be multiple sellers, but they're not multiple buyers. So it's less than an optimal market situation.
It's a monopsony.
Further questions?
Just one.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just getting hung up on bullet number two here. May not use other unreasonably low cost oil or gas as a basis for the valuation. So where's this determination being made and who's determining it?
Through the chair. Senator Rauscher, this is so in this particular provision, this is the royalty, the DNR. Commissioner, the Department of DNR would be coming up with the value that would be reasonably prevailing. And the concern that we added in the valuation may not be based on other unreasonably low costs is this idea that the quote market for the value would be based on other producers in Prudhoe Bay, and that possibly they would all be selling for $0. And so we are trying to get up at a reasonable price procedure in order to make sure that there's some value to this, to the royalty and production tax, which are percentages of the gross value.
Senator Rauscher.
And I understand what you're trying to do. I'm just trying to understand the control mechanism. That's all. That's all I'm trying to understand.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, just one last point on especially the royalty provision. I just want to point out that if we don't get a reasonable value for the royalty, that we lose out also to the permanent fund, because the permanent fund is based off of our royalty intake from the Alaska Constitution. And so that would be a concern that we wouldn't grow the permanent fund also if we don't receive fair value for our resource on the royalty end.
And fair value for our resource is our constitutional responsibility. Thank you. Are we moving to 17 now, slide 17?
Sure.
All right.
Madam Chair, yes. Slide 17 is the aspect of the bill that would now provide a 9.4 tax on the income over $5 million of S-Corps and LLCs who are engaged in natural gas pipeline activities, including carriers and producers and entities performing carbon capture or LNG processing, and also the sales aspect of the gas in case that there's a separate subsidiary set up to sell LNG for the export purposes that at the end of the gas line. And then we would want to capture their a tax on their income as well. It's determined using the same method as C corporations in existing law, because C corporations do pay tax on income. And the taxable amount would be attributable to entities also comprising the unitary business.
Very good. I see no questions. Slide 18.
And Madam Chair, as to that S-Corp and LLC tax, my discussion about a month ago now on equal protection would still apply in this setting as well. So I do not think that equal protection concerns would arise, but I'd be happy to take questions on that if anyone has concerns. The next revenue mechanism that we have in this bill would be a surcharge. And the surcharge would be on the processing of natural gas to liquid form. And so this would happen in the LNG plant in Nikiski. And it is 15 cents per MCF or 15 cents per 1,000 cubic feet. And this would apply to entities processing natural gas by cooling for the purpose of converting the LNG for transportation or storage, and it does not apply to small capacity plants, which would be on the order of 50 million cubic feet processing plants. And my understanding is that this, the plant in Nikiski for the LNG exporting is supposed to achieve at least 3 billion cubic feet per day processing.
Senator Myers has a question. Senator Myers?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So we're talking about 15 cents per 1,000 cubic feet, and the Wood-McKenzie study that was presented to us at the beginning of last year was positing a gas price of somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.25 per 1,000 cubic feet. So this is a significant increase on top of that, you know, potentially a 15% tax effectively. Are we concerned that this might depress the value of the gas and thereby then we actually get fewer royalties?
Madam Chair, Senator Myers, I'm not aware of concerns that this would depress the market and result in fewer royalties to us. I understand that we have very significant prospects for gas purchasing from foreign nations, and so I don't suspect that 15% could hinder development and export, but that's not to say that this number is the number that we should land on, because as Senator Giesel rightly pointed out at the start of the hearing, that she plans to request modeling on these provisions. So thank you for the question.
Senator Myers, Gaffney Klein will be presenting to the committee next Wednesday on this piece of legislation. This will be a great question. I'm sure that they will address. Further questions on slide 18? Seeing none, we'll move on to slide 19.
Okay, Madam Chair, this provision in the bill would just explicitly state that revenue generated through AGDC ownership or investment in a subsidiary should be separately accounted for and placed in a separate fund in the general fund and available for appropriation. And then this is stated in law that revenue can be used for AGDC operations if they are requesting funding for their operations, as they do right now through appropriations annually.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, that takes us to slide 20.
And actually, this is our last substantive slide. This provision in the bill would require AGDC to negotiate a contractual option to acquire an interest in a revenue-generating project when in negotiations with another entity over that prospect. And the option terms must be approved by the legislature. And so when we look at the model right now that AGDC entered into in the 8-star model with, Glen Farn, that if we think about the pipeline, they are telling us that we can invest 5 to 25%. So using that as an example, that would be where we would have an option for a future interest in a revenue-generating project. So right now, we do not know the terms of that agreement. They seem to be changing publicly. In public settings, they've been reformulated for us, and so I think we have some questions on that. But moving forward, whenever the situation arises where AGDC is negotiating an option to acquire an interest, the state will have the option to acquire the interest within 180 days at the time that the interest becomes ripe. When I say ripe, I just mean when it is ready for the state to decide whether or not to become involved in the interest. And so at the DOR, in this provision, DOR shall assist the legislature in deciding whether or not to acquire the interest. And our thought on that was that DOR is in a unique position to come up with possibilities for funding to enable exercise of the option. And then the legislature, again, would approve acquiring the interest. And then revenue generated would be separately accounted and available for appropriation.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So February 2nd, the governor put out his supplemental. And here we are, it's March, what is it, the 12th or 13th. So how does the legislature able to respond quick enough to be able to make the determinations here that we have to make in a timely manner? And I'm just using that one for an example. It's just a supplemental budget. So I'm trying to understand how we're going to be able to accomplish the terms in a timely manner. That's all. What's the plan there?
Senator Rauscher, I completely agree. I completely agree with you. This is Senator Geisel for the record. And that 6-month period is very much open to change. I agree with you. This is a very short time period. And if we're out of session, does that mean we call ourselves into special session? And that's only a 30-day scenario. So this number, I believe, needs to be changed. I share your concern.
Okay.
Further questions on this last slide? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Just a brief one on Section 9 on the state ownership. So if the state decides – so I'm sorry. If AGDC or the corporation negotiates this, makes up this negotiation, the state then – legislature has to pass an affirmative bill, and it says that they have to act as a prudent investor. What if they decide this is not a prudent investment? They would decline a bill, and then AGDC would have to – what would happen at that point?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that's actually an interesting principle. The state – we've been advised by attorneys that – by our legislative – nonpartisan legislative attorneys that the state acting as a prudent investor is probably not a provision of law that can be enforced. But the reason we put it into the bill was that we would like the state to act as a prudent investor just for the interest of the Alaskan public.
And certainly that is a slogan used by our Senate Finance Committee. Senator Myers, a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So my reading of this section of the bill, effectively we're moving the timeline to, instead of 6 months after FID, we now have 6 months after completion of the project to invest. And then at the same time, we're removing the cap of how much we can invest. So assuming we find a financing vehicle, my reading of this is that the state would then be allowed to buy out the entire project after it is done from the developer, and the developer would have no recourse. They can't say no to it because it's in the contract. Is that an accurate reading of this section?
Ms. Kawasaki?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that is an interesting interpretation. That was not the intent of this aspect of the bill. Essentially, when AGDC and the partnering entity consider the state's participation through the option, that at that time they would have to agree to the terms of what the option would look like if the state were to acquire an interest through it. So it would be probably not in the best interest of the partnering entity to enter into an option that would allow the state to just buy the whole project back once it's complete. So I suspect that a lot of that would come out in the wash during the negotiation for the option. And then the second question you had, I believe, has to do with the 180 days of which to exercise the option. Honestly, that was based on the fact that in public testimony that we've been told that we have 6 months to exercise the option. Now, I completely understand that if moving forward beyond what we have currently for the gas line project itself, if we want to actually be given more time, that that might be something that we will consider for this bill, is bifurcating whatever we can discern what AGDC has entered into in agreement with Glen Fern from a current the current option, because that's already a contract between them and we can't impair that contract. But moving forward, we might want to make it broader. And it, and Senator Myers, to your point, the reasonable assurance considering the totality of the circumstances, including review of all financial information, presumably AGDC would be able to have access to the information to determine if that time frame is ripe for the state to be confronted with whether or not to acquire the option. And that would normally be probably investing money. And so AGDC, in its partnership with Glen Fern in that situation, would be looking at the financials and deciding if it is too soon or for us to be confronted with that option. And I think that that AGDC probably has a duty in the best interest of the state to make sure that, that we're not being offered the opportunity too soon. And that was, I think, the provision, your read of the provision, that was what we were getting at, because we've been told two different things by AGDC versus Glen Fern, at which point we'd be allowed to invest. And I believe Glen Fern has told us in a private meeting that it has to do with full close of the project, which I wasn't really exactly sure what that meant, but it was full complete closure of the project. And then AGDC uses the term FID. And in order to capture both of those concepts, that's sort of what we came up with in law.
Thank you, Ms. Kawasaki. It is time to adjourn. Senator Myers, this will all be coming up again next Wednesday, so we can continue the questions at that time with committee members. So at this time, I'm going to set the bill aside. I want to thank the Department of Revenue, Acting Deputy Commissioner Derek Nottingham, Weston Nash, who was online. Thank you to Matt Kissinger from AGDC and Dan Stickle from the Department of Revenue for being available for questions. This concludes our meeting. Our next meeting will be Monday, March 16th at 3:30 p.m. On the agenda at that time will be SB 224, Public Lands, Sale, Lease, Commercial Development, a bill from the governor. Senate Bill 230, Jonesville Public Use Area, Senator Rauscher's bill. And Senate Bill 200, Farm and Agricultural Land Assessments, from Senator Bjorkman. At this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 5:07 p.m.